Go ahead.
Hello, this is the Pressure Podcast with my daddy.
Welcome to the Press Row Podcast, the definitive sports video game show, brought to you by Operation Sports. I'm your host, Richard Grisham. Well, hey everybody, thank you as always for listening to the Press Row Podcast, brought to you by Operation Sports, and also brought to you this week by the great folks at Sherry's Berries. More on them in a little bit. I want to thank everybody for the great feedback that we've given to us for some of the early shows we've done in 2015. Our old school baseball show with Chris Baker. Last week, Life in Basketball with Dazar. We've had a lot of fun mixing things up a little bit at the start of the new year. But don't worry, next week, as a matter of fact, we get the full panel, or most of the full panel, back together for a big 2015 sports game preview show. But this week, we're going to have some fun. We've got a real mix of a bunch of different things. Up first, we've got a Super Bowl preview with a couple of super fans, one of the Seahawks with Brian Wiedei and one of the Patriots with Steve Gibbons. We've got a look back, or really a revisit, of NHL 15. I spent quite a bit of time playing it recently, and we get Glenn Wigmore on, who is the Operation Sports, one of their hockey experts, to talk a little bit about that as well. There's been some very interesting news in the world of NASCAR video games, and we get our racing correspondent Greg Seward on to talk about what that means for NASCAR fans. And then we also have some big news in the baseball simulation world, where the long-renowned Out of the Park Baseball Series has recently announced that it has secured the Major League license for not only current teams, but teams of the past. So we talk with Out of the Park Baseball's Brad Cook about that. So it's a really, really fun, jam-packed episode. Football, baseball, hockey, and racing. So a whole mix of good stuff. And before we get to it, I also want to mention that the Press Row Podcast will be back in force at PAX East. We have our third straight panel. This is on Saturday, March 7th at 4:30 p.m. in the Bumblebee Theater. The Press Row Podcast will be back at PAX East. I'm really excited about that. More details on that as it comes close. So thank you again, everybody, for listening, and enjoy today's Winter Potpourri Show. Well, all right, it is almost Super Bowl time. The big game is upon us this weekend, the Seattle Seahawks versus the New England Patriots. And I decided to try to get a couple of folks on representing both of their teams. A little trash talk, a little Super Bowl preview. Not exactly sure what's going to happen when folks like these two get together, but we're going to have a little fun. We have, from Seattle, Mr. Brian Wiedei from Pasta Padre. Brian, how are you, sir?
You know, this is becoming an annual thing, Rich. You might want to reserve a seat for me next year also.
Oh, boy. Here we go. And it begins. And we also have, from Boston, Massachusetts, Mr. Stephen Gibson. Mr. Steve Gibbons. Mr. Yeah. S. Gibbs 7. How are you, sir? Welcome.
Doing well. That's not the first time I've been called Gibson, and it won't be the last, but I'm excited to be here. I hope to be on next year's show, just because that means the Patriots are back in the Super Bowl. So that's what I'm looking forward to coming up.
See, I'm so used to calling you S. Gibbs. You know what I mean?
It's just, yeah, it happens.
It just goes. So, well, all right. We have got S. Gibbs, obviously a fan of the Patriots. Brian Wiedei, obviously a fan of the Seahawks. So this is the big game, the Super Bowl. This is... Really, these are two franchises that have never met in a championship game, but they have long histories. New England's a little bit more of a championship pedigree, but obviously the Seahawks are the defending champions. So we'll just start off with you, Mr. Wiedei. What are your overall thoughts heading into this big game?
I'm feeling good. You know, I'm basking in the glow of the NFC Championship game. It's hard, you know, you don't really get over that quickly, and you have this 2-week period now where there's nothing really happening. I mean, they have all the media day and all this junk that's just silly, and you just kind of want to get to the game, you know. And so I feel comfortable. It's almost similar to how I felt last year, that it's like this quiet confidence I feel. I've never had that feeling in the past until really last year, because as a Seattle sports fan, you kind of figured the worst was going to happen at some point. I mean, as an Eagles fan, Rich, you kind of understand that feeling. And you know,
always have to go there. Why do you always have to go there? Can't you let me just suffer in peace?
A year ago, I was that guy too, Rich. I mean, I empathized with like Cleveland Browns fans, you know, the city of Cleveland. We were in that. I mean, it wasn't even just that the city of Seattle had hadn't won a championship since 79 with the Sonics. It was, you know, we had one of our teams ripped away. We had our Sonics taken away. So, I mean, for several years there, we were in just a depressed state. I was depressed. I didn't know if we'd ever get a championship here or whatever. But, man, you know, over the past 4 years, what Pete Carroll has done and John Schneider has done, it's remarkable. And it's almost surreal even still.
S. Gibbs, same question to you. Your overall thoughts heading into the Super Bowl?
Well, I've felt terrible this whole past week with everything and all the news about Deflategate, and I tried to not listen to any of the media or try to pay any attention to it, because after a couple of days, I kind of had the mindset of like, none of this that I'm listening to or watching is going to affect me. Like, it might affect the players and all that, but it's like literally ruining my life. It's making me sick to my stomach, uh-huh. Making me nervous, because I literally realized this past week how much I kind of basically look up to Tom Brady. I don't know if that, I mean, I'm a grown man at this point, but I've been following him since, you know, 2001 when he took over. And at that point in my life, I don't know, how old was I then? I can't even think back. I was like 13 years old. So, you know, this whole week has just been a nightmare for Patriots fans, because number one, you are worrying, okay, did they cheat? Because you have that mindset of, okay, if they did cheat, then now I feel terrible. And it's like, should I be happy they're in the game or whatever it is? But the past couple of days with Belichick's news conference on Saturday, then Kraft supporting him, and then kind of the recent news that have come out, it started to feel a little bit better. But then the other part that kind of concerns me is, if they had to spend that much time looking into the whether balls are deflated or not deflated, like, where did they lose time? Because you know, there's only 24 hours a day, so it's not like they could actually make up more time. So, you know, how is that going to affect the team? Whether they say it doesn't affect them or not, you know, they say ignore the noise in New England all the time. But my question is, where are we going to see this show up on Sunday? So that's kind of my biggest concern at this point heading into the game.
All right, so let's stick with you, Steve. What specific matchups, Patriots versus Seahawks, do you feel the best about? Where do you have the most confidence? Break it down for us Madden Bible style.
Yeah, so I feel the best about stopping Marshawn Lynch in the ground game, because the MO of the Patriots this whole year, any Super Bowl team has just been to take away the opponent's number one option. You saw a little bit last year actually with Aqib Talib, and you know, you saw it in primetime games like when they played the Saints and he held Jimmy Graham for whether it was zero catches or one catch, but he locked down Jimmy Graham, and you saw a lot of that this year, especially when they played the Colts. Different type of matchups, having Revis defend somebody, and then you are able to, you know, double coverage T.Y. Hilton with two guys over the top. And so I think that the Patriots are going to focus on loading the box with whether it's Brandon Brown, or you put in Brandon Brown on Luke Wilson, or you put Patrick Chung in the box. You're going to load the box with multiple defenders, eight defenders, and you're going to leave Revis on Baldwin. And then you're just going to kind of say, someone else win. So it's Jermaine Kearse. Is Jermaine Kearse going to show up, and is he going to win? Luke Wilson has to win his matchups. Russell Wilson, you know, can he get outside of the pocket? Can he make plays? But I feel the best about being able to stop the run and then forcing someone else to win. The other way I could see it going is, you know, how do the Patriots, do they want to say, well, we're going to just shut down Russell Wilson. We're going to contain him. We're not going to let him make any crazy plays. You know, that could be another way they go, but I feel pretty confident that they're going to load the box and make sure that Lynch doesn't have a big day.
Brian Widai, what specific matchup do you feel the best about?
Well, I think what was just being talked about there is interesting, because That's basically the idea that every team has when they face the Seahawks, right? And it doesn't always work out. But the Patriots have unique talent at corner, and certainly McCourty at safety. So maybe the impact is there. But for me, what I look at and what I feel best about is kind of opposite of what he was just saying there, and that's the run game. The Patriots are at the bottom of the league stopping power runs. So if the Seahawks do that, and we don't know really how they're also going to respond to read option, and if they can contain that or not, that's a difficult thing that teams have struggled with, and the Seahawks pulled it back out when they came back on Green Bay late in that game. So what I see as the strength there is the power run game, and if they try to take that away, if they're successful at taking that away, then yeah, that could be an issue.
So we'll stay with you, Brian. As a Seahawks fan, what scares you? What specific matchup concerns you the most?
And this is a concern for me because of the weakness for the Seahawks in the area, and that's pass blocking. So my concern is with guys like Chandler Jones and Jamie Collins coming rushing on the outside. The question is, are they going to try and contain Wilson? Is that going to affect their rush? They have to stay more disciplined in that way. But if they can force Wilson to get rid of the ball faster than he wants to, or if they can back the Seahawks up into third and long situations, that's going to be key for them, I think.
So Steve Gibbons, flipping it back over to you. As a Patriots fan, you look across the line at what Seattle's got going on. What specific matchup has you the most concerned?
Anytime we get to third down, I don't care if it's third and short, third and four, third and five, third and long, that's the down that scares me going against the Seahawks. The Patriots want to pass the ball. They'll run the ball, especially if they get a lead. They'll run the ball if they're facing the Colts. They'll run the ball in certain situations. But they want to pass the ball, right? So my concern is the kind of concern that's plagued the Patriots anytime they really, faced an opponent that they can't beat, right? So if you faced the Pittsburgh Steelers a couple of years ago, you faced the New York Giants, what was the kind of the MO to win those games? Well, you get pressure with your front four, you push the pocket back, specifically in the interior of the line. And I think that the Seahawks have the ability to get to Brady, especially whether or not, you hear all these reports about Stork being okay. He's okay in practice. There's no limping. There's no problems. But, how quickly does he go out of the game if he falls awkwardly? And then you have to bring in Klein, move him to guard, move Wendell over to the center. So, the biggest issue with the Patriots all season has been the offensive line. And that goes into this game is you can't get into third and long situations. If there's too many of those, I think that the Patriots could get into big time trouble in this game.
So, sort of, we'll flip it on you a little bit. S. Gibbs, the Seahawks will win if?
Seahawks win if they force a turnover just before half. The Patriots this season.
That's very specific.
I know. Yeah, the Patriots this season, and a lot of it has actually been Brady himself. So you think of Brady, never makes mistakes. Tom Brady, best quarterback ever, right? But this season, he has made some bonehead plays, whether it's a big game, it's not a big game, it doesn't matter. He's been turning the ball over just before half, and that's usually a big problem because if depending on if the Seahawks get the ball at half or whoever gets the ball there, we're trying to score points, obviously, and then you turn it over, and then you get a twofer. It's like a 10-point swing situation where you can't turn over. Think of the Ravens game where they're driving, and he throws the pick over the middle of the field, and they're able to get some points on the board. That has been a big problem for us this year, and if the Seahawks can capitalize on that, then they're going to win the ball game.
Brian Weedy, the Seahawks will win if?
They have to get into manageable third down situations, and they have to convert at a high rate. They need to keep drives going, and they have to have Lynch moving the ball on the ground to be successful in that regard, but they have to be in third and short to mid situations. Third and long is a very bad that's a very bad situation for the Seahawks offense. They don't convert at a very good clip third and 10 or longer. So if they can keep things manageable and then convert at a higher rate on third downs, I think it's going to be trouble for the Patriots to pull off a game in that regard.
Conversely, Brian Weedy, the Patriots will win if?
They have to win the turnover battle. Now, I say this with Green Bay having just won the turnover battle, and they still couldn't win the game. But I think what the Patriots need, the only way you're going to get points on the Seahawks, you're not going to get it on long, sustained drives in most cases. They have to start with good field position. So they need turnovers. They need a couple turnovers probably. And they have to start in good field position. And they can also do that with special teams. So I think turnover battle plus good returns on special teams would set them up well.
S. Gibbs, the Patriots will win if?
If Julian Edelman gets 10 touches. Whether he catches the ball as a receiver, whether he gets wide receiver end rounds out of the backfield, get the ball in his hands. He is the guy that starts everything for us. I know obviously that Gronkowski is the focal point of the offense and everyone talks about him. But Julian Edelman gets everything started. When he is high energy, it seems as though the team kind of rebounds off of his energy and they feed off of what he's providing. So get him the ball. Get him the ball often, and I think that the Patriots can end up winning this game.
All right, so let's get down to the real business at hand. Steve Gibbons, what is your prediction for the Super Bowl?
21-17, the Patriots win on a game-winning drive at the end of the game.
Wow. Touchdown. Nice. Brian Widai, your Super Bowl prediction.
That would kill me. That would take me back to the 2012 Seahawks defense, which gave up leads at the end of the games. I like the Seahawks. Obviously, it's not like I'm going to pick the Patriots here. 27-17. I think we're both in agreement that we like the under. Obviously, the being 48, we like the under. I think it could be fairly low scoring, at least to start the game off. But 27-17 is what I'm looking at.
Wow, I'm shocked. Neither of you have picked what the actual score is going to be. It's going to be 14-13 Seattle based upon the simulation that Brian and I played over on Pasta Padre the other day. I mean, clearly that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and Gronkowski's going to get hurt.
Yeah, right.
Amendola's going to get hurt.
Yeah. That got ugly.
That was in the first half, yeah. So that was some big Legion of Boom hits in that game.
I believe it. You know, I want to add one other thing in this, that I feel like I left out, which is about something the Patriots need to do if they need to win this game. It's actually something the Seahawks, I think, need to do as well if they want to win. But if the Patriots can score in the red zone, you obviously saw last week that was a big reason why the Packers lost. Yes, Seattle turned the ball over, but the fact – how many times did the Packers get the ball down inside like the five-yard line and only came away with 6 points?
I'll tell you, as a fan at the game, we're – the crowd in those situations, because the Packers chose to kick field goals – a couple times they had a fourth and goal at the one and a fourth and goal at the two, and we're taking a sigh of relief. You know, we're cheering because they chose to kick field goals. Yeah, the teams have to put up touchdowns in those situations. Field goals aren't going to get it done, and this defense is especially good in the red zone, so it's a challenge.
Yeah, and the Patriots can, man, they can get bogged down sometimes. They do a couple plays very specific where they'll start Shane Vereen out wide. It usually comes in a trips formation. They'll have Vereen split wide on the side with Gronkowski, who's on the line of scrimmage as a tight end. And basically they start him wide, motion him in. They're just looking for a man's own read. If they get a man read, he runs basically an angle route out of the backfield, and then you have Gronk who runs like a quick out. And they're kind of just playing those two guys. That's Brady's read. He's looking at them. If it's zone, you'll see Vereen run an option. You'll see that Gronk will run the same type of route, but instead of running the out, he just turns and sits. I think everyone knows that's coming. Like, if I know that's coming, like, then Seattle knows that's coming. So that's what – that kind of concerns me a little bit. You know, we'll see what happens. But watch for it. You're going to see it in the game. You're going to see – anytime you see Vereen going out and then motions them back in, you'll see it a lot in the red zone. They're looking for that man zone read, and then they run their routes accordingly once they get that man zone read.
Well, good stuff. Steve Gibbons from MaddenTips.com. He and Z Farrells are the men behind This Week in Madden. When do we get to see This Week in Madden?
This Week in Madden is every single Wednesday on twitch.tv/MaddenTips at 8 p.m. Eastern. We go live, again, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're on there for about 2 hours, sometimes three. But you can find us every single day streaming on twitch.tv/MaddenTips every single day, usually around 12 p.m. Eastern.
Good stuff. And Brian Midday, as always, we can find everything that you're doing over at PastaPadre.com, including the simulation of the Super Bowl, the Patriots versus the Seahawks, where your Seahawks somehow prevailed. I'm still not sure how that happened. I had it. I had it right there. It
well, I could have. I could have blown you out too, but I made mistakes in the second half also. So, but the outcome was correct.
Well, gentlemen, I can't say good luck to both of you because one of you is going to have good luck and one of you isn't. Yeah. So,
well, last year Gus had the bad luck. So,
that's true.
I'm looking forward to. I'm excited because it's two very balanced teams, I think, and of course last year we had the top offense versus the top defense, and we thought that was going to turn out into be an epic battle, and we not quite. But I think this year these teams are really strengths up against strengths and weaknesses up against weaknesses almost in some areas. So there's not many weaknesses, but it's a compelling matchup, I think.
Agreed. Will there be a safety in this game? There's been one of the last three Super Bowls.
Yeah, that's – no, I would think.
No way that streak lasts. There's no way.
Right? It can't last.
Yep. All right, gentlemen, enjoy the Super Bowl and have fun watching it. And as Gibbs, hopefully the snow clears a little bit by the time it's game time. And everybody have a great time. Enjoy the Super Bowl, and we will talk to you again real soon.
Had a dream. To come to the fault line, we heave relief as scores of innocence die and the Andalusian tribes setting the lay of Nebraska alight till all that remains is the arms of the angel.
Well, all right, the end of the NFL season is upon us. We are getting into that time of year where if you are an American sports fan, or North American sports fan, you've got the NBA and the NHL. Obviously, international soccer continues apace. But for your typical North American, Canadian, or United States sports fan, it's all about basketball and hockey. And while we have tread well over the difficult launch of NHL, EA's NHL franchise on next generation consoles, as we head into really the time of the year where NHL will come much more center stage, I thought it would be interesting to dive back into NHL 15 on next gen consoles, and who better to join me for that conversation than Operation Sports resident hockey correspondent, Mr. Glenn Wigmore. Glenn, welcome back to the Press Row Podcast.
Always good to be back, Rich.
So, as I mentioned, it was about a week or so ago. I was just sitting around thinking, I'm like, man, I play a lot of sports games these days. I'm deep into NBA 2K. I'm deep into Madden, in our online league. I play a lot of Pro Evo these days, really enjoying that. And it had been a while since I played NHL, really not since I finished my review. And I thought, I know they've been doing some updates for the game. I'm a big NHL fan of the franchise for years past. I want to dive back in. I hadn't gotten rid of it and kept it around. I wanted to dive back in and sort of see what it's like these days, because there's still many, many, many months before any new NHL game comes out. And so I did that, and I got to think it'd be a good conversation to have. So I want to start with you, Glenn. You have been regularly playing NHL for, even after launch in the last few months. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean it's a game that I've a franchise I've loved for years, and I've covered for Operation Sports, and it's NHL is, it just does so many things well, or it certainly has over the years, and this year I have been steadily playing it, but of course it's been a bit, muted in some ways because of just the lack of ways to play the game. So I've certainly kept up with the franchise and this year's game because I like a lot of what it does. But, as I said in my own review, it there's just not a lot of ways to play the game. And so that's sort of been a tough thing to reconcile. So I've had to, I'm really an online focused guy. So, you know, I do a lot of online versus and that sort of thing. And excuse me. And now that they've added online team play, that's been another sort of getting back to what we had last year with EA Sports Hockey League and that sort of thing. But of course, that's been sort of fraught with its own problems. So I've certainly been a steady player of the game, even with all the issues this year's version has had.
So, and we're going to get into each of these things as well as the way that I've been playing it. So just for starters, if somebody were to go pick up NHL 15 today, you know, late January 2015, mm-hmm. and plop it into their Xbox One or PlayStation 4, they're going to get a bunch of patches, a bunch of updates. What is the experience like now on the ice? Is the experience on the ice different than at launch? And is it a good experience on the ice, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, they certainly have patched and tuned the game quite a bit. There's been a lot of tuner updates, a lot of patches, and, you know, some of them have been adding new content, whereas others have addressed sort of glitches and minor issues. But in terms of gameplay focus changes, I mean, I can't say the game is radically different than when it launched. I mean, there are still, there have been some things they've fixed in terms of, you know, if you're playing with a lower skilled player, initially sort of some of the deking or the way those players would be penalized if they were deking too much, they wouldn't lose control of the puck as easily as maybe they do now, or they've changed where some of the prime scoring areas can take place. But a lot of the game's feel at the launch is sort of similar to now, where there's a lot of weight and there's a lot of pace to the game. And that was very different than NHL 14, which was, you know, a lot more physicality, the fighting, the big hits, and that's all there now. But of course, in adding these new collision physics where everybody on the ice is live, and the puck physics, that's created a lot more sort of unpredictability, and that can be really fun in sometimes, but there's other instances online and offline where that causes a lot of problems and sort of isn't sort of as enjoyable. It's a bit of a mess. And so I would say that while there have been some updates to sort of some of the, you know, tweaking the way AI pressures you a bit or handling some of those deking situations, the game pretty much plays in a similar way to how it did, I would say.
And I actually, you know, again, I've probably played about 12 offline games and, I don't know, 6 online games. So it's not like I've played another 50 hours in the last week or so, but I've got back into it and played that amount. And I really, you know, it's interesting. I'm trying to put my finger on it. I think in many ways on the ice, it is a really good game. It feels more realistic from a speed perspective than of the NHLs of the previous generation, which is slower, I think.
Like, definitely.
And it takes a little bit of getting used to, but I like that. You know, you mentioned the collision physics. It's interesting. Sometimes when I go for a big hit and I make that hit, both guys fall down.
Topple over, yeah.
And the puck's just sitting there. And yeah. Then sometimes no one else does anything. I'll just kind of wait, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But other times I'll lay a guy out and I'll be rewarded for it. I'll be able to – my guy won't fall over. I'll be able to pick up the puck and do something with it. It's – you know, there is some randomness. It is interesting. It's like, you know, I kind of like it, and it's just, but it is so different in so many ways than previous NHL games. It takes some real getting used to. Even though I haven't played a previous gen NHL game in a while, it's just, again, I keep having this sort of, I like it. I really do like a lot about it, but all told, there's still just, it doesn't feel like it is completely put together in all facets of the game on the ice. Is that fair?
And I agree with that completely. It's interesting you talked about the last gen version, because I actually still play NHL 14 on Xbox 360 with my brother. And it's funny kind of going back, you know, that's the current console he has, so we play that version. But I, of course, have an Xbox One and I play the NHL 15 on that. But it's funny going back and forth, and you really do see that pronounced speed difference in terms of how the players move, the weight of the hits. And what I've really noticed online with NHL 15 and offline as well is, I mean, I guess more if you're playing with local players or online with internet players, you really see people struggling with the kind of that pace and that speed and the inertia that is now present when you have these sort of the players just feel heavier and they feel weightier. And
yes.
And that's something that there was big hitting and all that in NHL 14. But I think that's something people are really kind of adjusting to still. And I do agree with you that on the whole, I really like the gameplay. I like a lot of what it does. I like the feel that, you know, of the shot release and the frenzy of the crowd and the big hits, and the defense, you know, generally sort of does the job. But with me, like, I think it's the collision physics. It's definitely a first-year effort. Like, I really like that direction. It's the dreaded, they've made a great foundation, you know? Like,
yeah.
I know that's the dreaded the phrase, but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
I like the direction they're going with the puck physics and the collision physics. On the other hand, what you have happen is when you just left stick into somebody with your movement stick, not the right hit stick, you can basically knock people over for free and there are no penalties. And so I think the development team really probably had a struggle going, oh, wow, like, we're, you know, these new collision physics we've introduced are allowing people to just kind of run into each other with the left stick, but we don't want to penalize them for just skating around. They're not actively trying to hit somebody, but they collided. But that can have the unintended consequence of creating a breakaway or getting you scored on. And even like it, how it's tied into the penalty system, where I had a breakaway the other day in NHL 15, like, you know, the current gen version, the new version, and on a breakaway, and I went for a deke and scored, but as I was scoring, my knee bumped the goalie's knee, and what? They called that interference.
Yes,
and
yes.
They called that goalie interference, and it was baffling. That was the craziest one I'd ever seen, where there was really no interference, but the game couldn't reconcile that system, the collision system. So.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that, so interesting. I'm playing a playoff. The playoff mode was one of the modes that was introduced post release, where mm-hmm. you can just go in and jump into a playoff, and you can, you know, set it to be any team. And I'm going to talk for a minute about some of the cool things about that. But at one point, I was playing a game 7 of the – it was the Ducks versus the Stars.
Sure.
And I scored what I thought was the goal. I mean, it was clearly I did the right thing. I did a nice little deke, and then I went, you know, left, right, went top shelf on the right, and it went in. But the guy in front of the goaltender just, I guess – slightly bumped the goaltender, and as the puck went in, the whistle blew, and I got called for goalie interference as well. So that seems to be one of those things that is – I mean, I don't really see that very much ever when I watch real NHL hockey, but it seems to be something that's happening a little more often than I would like, because that's at least two of those I can count on that happened just in that 1-7-game series.
And it's almost you can see the game's logic. You can see the cogs turning on some of those plays. I mean, the situation I had was the player shooting the puck was the one who also sort of needed the goalie. But when it's another player, you can see where the game is almost sort of waiting to see what happens if one of your teammates collides with the goalie. And then if the puck goes in, instantly they call the penalty. It's like sort of they're waiting to see if that play results in a goal, and then they will call the interference penalty. And sometimes if the goal doesn't, if puck doesn't go in, they won't call the penalty. So it's this weird sort of half solution they have to their collision physics. It's a bit weird.
I will say there's been some really interesting things that have happened too. Again, just staying on the ice. Like, I really like how the puck will just kind of wildly carom at some point in a way that looks very realistic in ways
very much.
That I've never seen the puck behave in any hockey game before. You know, sometimes it'll like bounce off the boards and then roll on its side for a little bit, and other times it'll go in different directions. It feels more realistic than before. Another just sort of random interesting thing that happened at one point in a different series that I was playing, there was a big scrum in front of the net, and one of the guys got shoved into the goaltender, and the goaltender's helmet went flying. I was like, oh, that was really cool.
You know, looks so great. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a bunch of cool moments, and the crowd too. I mean, you mentioned the arenas and the crowd. Like, when you score a big goal and all of a sudden everybody jumps out of their seats, there's really cool. So there's some really cool things that'll happen when you're playing NHL 15, no doubt.
They really do. They capture that frenzy. I even nominated, I think, the crowd tech for one of our best new features of the year for our OS awards that we do. I mean, it didn't win, but I thought it deserved recognition for, you know, the beats NHL 15 has taken. You know, that was something they captured really well in terms of just the frenzy when a goal is scored and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, on ice, as you say, there's a lot of things that game does very well in terms of how it plays and how it moves and just how certain shots look and the puck bounces being a lot more reasonable. I mean, sometimes it does. There are little short passes occasionally still that, you know, a high level player is struggling with, like a tiny little 4 foot pass, and he's sort of trying to knock it down. And I do like that dose of reality, but again, it's sort of this adjustment period that I think a lot of the users will have to kind of, you know, over a couple of years get now that there's sort of a little less pass assist and there's a little more bounce in the puck and that sort of thing.
All right, we're going to take a very quick break from our NHL 15 discussion. We're going to talk about our sponsor for this week, Sherry's Berries. These guys are really good. As we know, or as you may not know, but you should know, guys, Valentine's Day is coming up very soon. We are, what, about 2 weeks maybe? Wow, 2 weeks from Valentine's Day. And let me tell you this, if you are married or you have a girlfriend or you have any sort of a significant other, if she tells you she doesn't want anything for Valentine's Day, what she means is you better get me something for Valentine's Day. We all know that's the truth. And look, if you show her that you thought of something unique and different this year and you get her the gift she's sure to love, Sherry's Berries, you're going to be doing all right by yourself. Just this past week, I had a order sent to my house of their, it was a dozen chocolate-covered strawberries, and they were fantastic. I didn't even, get to them. They got here a couple hours before I got home, and between my wife and my son, those two maniacs devoured half of the box. They were these giant freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries, and there were several different varieties. There were some that were dipped in white chocolate. There were some that were dipped in milk chocolate. These guys were covered in chocolate chips. Some of them had a different sort of a decorative swizzle. Some of them had nuts. They were fantastic. And even better, about half the box was gone in a couple of hours. Like I said, my son, once he tore into them, look out. Then I put them in the fridge, and 4 days later, I took one out, and it was still good. You're going to do all right if you get yourself if you get your wife or your girlfriend or your significant other these things. These are giant freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries. They start at $19.99, which is a 40% savings if you go to berries.com and you click on the microphone and type in my code PressRow. And as a special bonus for the listeners of the PressRow podcast, you can double the berries for just $10 more, but you have to use that code PressRow. That is 40% off. You just need to use the code PressRow when you order. These things are giant. They're romantic. They're fresh. They're juicy. They're really good. Trust me on this one. I would not steer you wrong. So here's what you got to do. The only way to get this great Valentine's Day deal for these giant, juicy, freshly dipped strawberries starting at $19.99 or double the berries for $10 more, visit berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner. Type in PressRow. Go to berries.com, click on the microphone, enter my code PressRow. Order today for Valentine's Day. You will not be disappointed. Now, one of the other things that I do, and again, I've been playing NHL games for a long time. Right, as I'm sure you have. And I tend to just, I don't know what it is, I just tend to do the same thing over and over again. I'm doing the same thing in NHL 15 that I've done for years, which is when I have the puck, I try to skate down, try to sort of skate sometimes into the slot and then sort of move left to right and take a shot. But a lot of the other times I'll sort of skate into, not deep into the corner, but, you know, near the faceoff circle down low, you know, near the net and sort of wait for a guy to either get in front of the net and try to feather it over to him or head it back to the point. And hopefully my defenseman has gotten around there working around. I tend to do the same things that I've been doing for 10 years. Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Am I missing something? Is NHL 15 doing more for me than that? And am I not taking advantage of it? Or is that still pretty much the way to play offense in NHL 15?
Well, yeah, it's funny that you say that because it's, you know, in playing some more today and in the last couple of weeks, it really is one-timers for me have become the goal du jour again, and that's kind of unfortunate that the game has sort of – there are certainly – don't get me wrong. There are other great ways to score, deflections, rebounds, great-looking goals from all situations. But, you know, one-timers are very effective. The AI does them a lot. Everyone online does them. I do them. It's a way to score because you'll get so many just tap-in one-timers or but it's kind of – yeah, I agree it's unfortunate that you don't want to really – fall into the trap of just doing the same sorts of plays. And I try and play a cycle game. I pass the puck a lot and try shots from the point and that sort of thing. But honestly, if the AI, you know, which is its other whole kettle of fish, you know, if even at the highest levels, if the AI struggles to kind of push you and make you do other things, your only really resort is to go online and hope that the human competition can make you change up your strategies. And that's why I've always tried to play a possession game. But I mean, sometimes you need to score goals. And for me, that means trying a one-timer or getting to the slot for some kind of, you know, wrister in the slot when I've misdirected the defense and that sort of thing. So
a couple cool things, again, about the playoff mode, which really is kind of meant for me because, I mean, who doesn't love the Stanley Cup playoffs? When I first booted it up, and of course, you know, playoff mode didn't exist when I was reviewing it.
Sure. Likewise, yeah.
So, you know, booted up, and then I was like, okay, start a new playoff. I adjusted the teams a little bit. I put my Devils in there because, you know, I'm a Devils fan, and they were in the playoffs last year. And then I went to go pick them, and I'm like, wait a second, it's not letting me – pick the team. What the heck? This is broken. I don't get it. And then I realized that you could play any game at any time, right? You don't have to pick your team. You can play any game. You can simulate any game, or you can play it. And I realized that's a really nifty little thing. And so that way, instead of just being the Devils in the playoffs, I've actually wound up dabbling in a whole bunch of different games. Like I said, I was playing the Ducks. You know, the Ducks and the Stars wound up going to a Game 7, so I played Game 7 of that, and I played one of the Bruins Red Wings game. And so, you know, the playoff mode I thought was really cool in that regard. You know, the presentation is interesting. Unlike years past, when you're in the playoffs, it's not all about the playoffs. Like, yes, they do have the graphics, you know, painted on the ice.
You got the towels waving and that sort of thing.
You got the towels waving, but not as crazy feeling as they waved in the past.
Sure,
you know?
Sure, yeah.
And sometimes Doc Emrick and Eddie Olczyk will mention that it's the playoffs, and sometimes they won't.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That's always a little weird. It's just, yeah. You know, how much audio can they really record, right? So it's a bit of a tough sell there sometimes.
And like at one point, you know, in the Game 7, the intro did, you know, they were saying it's Game 7. It was generic, of course, because, I mean, how many versions of a Game 7 can you record, particularly for the Ducks and the Stars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just one of those things where I guess I've kind of been spoiled by the past NHL games really ramping up. You know, when it's the playoffs, they would always say what game it is and you know, who's up and who's down and this and that. But on the other hand, you know, I was impressed at the end of Game 7. They had, you know, the team leap off the, you know, the winning team. In fact, it was an overtime win. The team leapt off the bench and, you know, skated around their goaltender, gave him congratulations. Then they had the handshake, you know, at the end of the series. So,
yeah.
You know, they had some of the stuff in there. And so, you know, it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting where it is. It still feels, you know, even 5 months from now that, you know, it's good in some ways, but it's still not a complete product. You know, and there's all those sort of little touches that you know, sort of make me feel that way.
Well, and it's just, yeah, I mean, this has been my biggest problem with it. It's why the game got the scores it did from people like yourself and me and other outlets. It's just the game was clearly rushed, and it was higher up people at EA, I suspect, who put the pressure on this product. And what really bothered me in a lot of the stuff I wrote is that usually, you know, consumers and creators have kind of a compact between them about a product being released and, you know, year over year and kind of an understanding. And I think them skipping a year and then kind of not offloading the last generation version to a different development studio. Like, it was interesting. I talked to HB Studios, the golf club guys, and they used to do NHL, like the ports of the old versions. And I'm just sort of like, you guys make all this money at EA. Like, why aren't you paying someone else to help you out? Like, offload that last generation version, which seems to have had very few changes made to it, and put some more effort into the next gen version. Like, I respect the hell out of the development team of NHL, but it just seems like they had an arm tied behind their back and had to ship this product that they're now just trying to kind of plug in basic features that, I mean, we still don't have a creation suite in there. You know, we don't have obviously the major modes like EASHL and that sort of thing. And I kind of, my fear is that NHL 16 might just be kind of putting in EASHL and maybe a couple of other little things and sort of hanging their hat on that, because they've been having to patch this game, you know, NHL 15 repeatedly. And is that taking away from the next development time? It's just really kind of an unfortunate situation that this game is a big cognitive dissonance. Like you say, the on-ice action in a lot of ways is really good, but then you just have a limited number of ways to play it. And that's been kind of the hard thing for me as such a fan of the franchise. Like, I didn't want to be down on the game, but I've still played it, like, throughout all these months. I've still enjoyed it and in my own sort of limited way, you know, one-on-one online, that sort of thing. But boy, I wish there were more ways to play it, especially with friends.
So to me, when I'm playing against the computer, it feels to me like all pro slash simulation is the right balance. Because when I first got back in, I was playing on pro. And right. while it's not like I was, you know, killing my opponents, the statistics were out of whack. I would always have a lot more shots. And I was always have a lot more, you know, time of attack. And when I bumped it up to all pro, not only am I winning some games and losing some games, just the shots on goal were much more even, the hits were more even, the time of attack was more even. So
sure.
that feels to me to be the right sort of setting. Is that your setting as well? Do you agree with that, or how?
Everyone's different, right? I mean, I generally speaking, you know, just, you know, pat myself on the back here. You know, I play on superstar and hardcore settings, which are the two highest. And, you know, I certainly, for certain modes, I'll turn it down to like all-star or pro if I just want to play be a pro or something like that and kind of have a little more freedom on the ice. But if I'm playing sort of competitively against the computer, I would stick with the two highest settings for both the sliders and the difficulty. And to me, that creates a nice challenge for like where I'm at with the game, where I can still lose occasionally against the AI, but generally speaking, I will win a majority of the time. But it's still a competitive game, and so I get something out of that. But I mean, everybody's different, and of course, the slider community, you know, they go crazy changing things and making a balance that suits their style. So it's there's no right way, I would say. It's just it depends if you like to see a lot of goals or if you like the computer to press you. I mean, they still don't do enough of that, I would say, the AI, but they got better this year about at least closing some of the gaps. But, you know, of course, you know, crossing the blue line, I find, is still way too easy. And some of those one-timer chances are a little too wide open. But, you know, the computer does knock down a lot of the cross-crease passes and that sort of thing, and they will hit you quite a bit on the half boards. So it's everybody kind of has their own style, and you know, depends how long you played the franchise and what you really want out of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, good point. So we talked a little bit about playoff, which was one of the post-ship modes. And online team play is one of the other key modes, the precursor to the we all, you know, strongly assume will be a reintroduced EA Sports Hockey League next year. So you played a bunch of OTP. How has that been? What's worked well and what maybe hasn't worked so well?
Well, yeah, sad to say that the entire mode is kind of reflective of the rest of the product, unfortunately. It's kind of a rushed thing to sort of, I guess, check off a box and appease people who are upset it wasn't there in the first place. I mean, I won't say that it's been all bad. I mean, I've enjoyed some moments in some games I've played, but, you know, there's a lot that it doesn't do. You can't play as goalies, so it's only a 5-on-5 experience. You know, you sort of position lock before the game, and that, of course, causes problems. I often play defense. I'm pretty good forward, but I like playing defense because often people won't pick that, and so you want to try and create a balanced team for your squad, but you know, and then you get into the game and it's difficult. You can't really match up with friends. So you have to sort of game the system to even have a friend play on your side. And, you know, there can be some really good games if everybody on the ice knows what they're doing. But if you have some troublemakers, you know, you have people going offside, people can pause the game whenever they want. And so that's really frustrating where people can just pause the game. And, you know, there definitely ends up being a lot of situations where the collision physics get pretty crazy where people are all running into each other. But again, if people are generally pretty good on the ice, I've had some competitive games. So you can kind of see the spark of where it was with the EASHL. But of course, that mode was predicated on playing with your friends who kind of knew what they were doing. So it's good to see them put online team play back in. You know, connectivity wise, it works pretty well in terms of latency. But I still think there's some trepidation from the development side on how they should handle the collision physics when it comes to 10 or 12 online players. I just don't know if they know how to handle that in terms of gameplay, you know, penalties, in terms of chances, breakaways, goals, you know, unintended, you know, you back into somebody, you don't get a penalty, that causes a breakaway. You know, there's some things they still have to figure out for next year, I think.
And, you know, I think that the thing that to me just doesn't even make any sense, like you cannot play online team play with your friends. It's all just completely random. Or are there ways to at least sort of try?
Oh, yeah. Me and my friends do play, but it's I can get one or two people in. You basically have to hit the quick match button at right. the same time and hopefully end up in the same room, which you can do quite often. So you can kind of game it. But I mean, that's not a very elegant solution. You know, right. It's sort of you're kind of rejigging this thing to make it work for you, and it's just, yeah, you're kind of begging them to put in some increased functionality that would make that mode sort of work a little better.
And, I mean, let's face it, right? I mean, the online team play mode is – basically, it is a beta for EA Sports Hockey League, right? I mean, that's really what this is. They're just almost making sure that the basics can work so that they can then next year bring back the things that people love about EA SHL, which are your own specific clubs and the banner raisings if you win and all those kind of things, right? I mean, that's got to basically be what this is.
Pretty much, I would say that's accurate. I mean, it's interesting on that vein because EA did a survey recently and they were talking about EASHL, and to sort of look forward a bit of what it might be, it was the most intriguing question to me that they asked was, what do you want to see? Do you want to see kind of the way it's been, where you're sort of trying to raise your stats as high as they can be and kind of max out, sort of juice out this one character? Or do you want it to be purely based on skill, and you unlock sort of special like attributes and skills for specific player types? So almost really making the player types, you know, power forward, sniper, very distinct. And so that those players, like everyone has the same amount of stat points in that second scenario, and that now they're getting these sort of special animations and abilities that would be more unique. And I think that's a direction people have wanted the series to go for a long time. You know, a grinder should feel like a grinder. A power forward should, you know, be able to carve to the net and cause trouble. You know, a sniper should be the only person on the ice with those high-level shots, whereas kind of the way online team play and EA Sports Hockey League are now, or were, is people just kind of trying to max out their characters, and everyone's kind of fast and wiry and can shoot hard wrist shots. And so I think that's really intriguing if they do commit to this other option of making character types very distinct. And I think that would be something that would increase sort of the whole team play aspect, where people, they like cooperating. I like, you know, all my friends enjoy playing a role on the team and contributing in kind of a unique way. And I think that would really help further that idea.
So, believe it or not, it doesn't feel like it. It feels like it's been forever since NHL 15 launched. But there's still 5 months left till the Stanley Cup Finals and 8 months left until, you know, NHL 16 launches, assuming it launches during the traditional time frame it does, which is September. Mm-hmm. So is NHL, let's say you're somebody with the Xbox One or PlayStation 4, you're a hockey fan, you heard all the terrible, you know, initial reviews and complaints about NHL 15, but, you know, now the Super Bowl is just about here, and next thing you know, it's February, and you know, you're a hockey fan. I mean, is it worth it for someone to go out and pick up NHL 15? I mean, I would think, I mean, if you look on Amazon, you can get deals for it. You can get brand new for less than $50. You can pick up a used copy for $30. I mean, is it worth it for somebody to go out and pick up NHL, you know, with still basically between, you know, 5 to 8 months between the Cup Finals and the next game still shipping?
Well, yeah, fair enough. A couple scenarios here, I think. I mean, one, I sort of stand by what I originally said in the review in terms of, even though I had a lot of issues, and I think a lot of sort of mid-level and hardcore fans would have issues with the product, if you're somebody who just wants a one-on-one online experience, a basic sort of playing the computer, a sort of simple spin on a career mode with Be a Pro, if that's kind of all you're looking for, the game still does those things. And clearly there are a lot of people on the boards and on the internet who enjoy just that kind of simple experience, and that's fine. And I think, you know, if you can get the game for $30 or $40 through a sale, that's a totally viable and fair, you know, price for that experience. If you don't want statistical depth and crazy franchise modes and big team play and all that. On the other hand, the caveat I would add is that I've been pretty good at predicting what's going to come up on EA Access, and I have to believe hockey is the next one. I kind of knew they would do UFC next, and that's what they did, and I'm almost certain hockey will be the next one, probably around February or March, just because of the sales of the game. So
yeah, well, there you go. That's interesting. So for Xbox One EA Access subscribers, it's definitely a different potential choice if you can hold out than it is for PlayStation 4 owners, for example, who don't have that option. Interesting. And one other thing I want to mention before we go, too, is the online games. I've played about 6 online games, and they've all worked pretty darn well. I mean, no problems, no real lag, no disconnections, no wonkiness. I mean, the online worked great. I played Cat Bailey a few times. I played a couple of randoms a couple of times. I played another one of a buddy of mine, my neighbor down the street. You know, and Cat lives across the country.
Sure, yeah.
You know, my neighbors, and so it's probably worth saying, right? That, you know, it's a limited sample size, but the online worked pretty well too. And when you're playing a friend, right? If you're playing one on one versus a friend in NHL, that's a pretty fun experience as well.
It definitely is. And that game still sort of has that pedigree. I mean, I've had a couple of friends who I think they have their own sort of little connection issues. So occasionally playing with them has been a bit weird. But on the whole, yeah, like playing randoms or playing other friends, it's been totally fine. And EA really does right by their online stuff, I would say, in terms of like connectivity. Like I, you know, noticed that with UFC, I play that a lot and their connections for that are great. And that's something with a lot of inputs and hockey is the same. And even the online team play with 10 people, it works really well. EA has always been a little cagey about saying that, but I think their team modes have always used some kind of dedicated server option. But for the one-on-one play, it's always just peer-to-peer connection. But they seem to do pretty good netcode, and yeah, it does play really well. And that experience is very much, you know, it's a lot of fun, especially if you get a nice competitive balance between, you know, two people who are about the same skill level at the game, and they can just have fun with it. Yeah, it works really well.
All right, well, Glenn Wigmore, the official hockey correspondent for
We have a couple of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. And we'll have you back on again over the course of the year talking about UFC, more hockey, and some other good stuff as it comes up. How about that?
Sounds good, Rich. Yeah, cool. Look forward to it.
Awesome. Well, thank you, sir. You have a great rest of January. Enjoy the Super Bowl, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Sounds good. Go Seahawks.
Well, all right. Whenever there is important NASCAR-related things to discuss, we bring on the official NASCAR Press Row podcast guy. I wish I had a better title for you, but I don't. We welcome back my friend, the great Greg Seward, to the Press Row podcast. Mr. Seward, how are you, sir?
When NASCAR news breaks, I fix it.
The NASCAR correspondent. That's the word I was looking for.
There you go. I'm good.
It's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's nice to be back, and very nice show. I think probably a couple weeks ago now with enemy of the Player One podcast, Chris Baker.
Yes,
it's cool to listen. I don't even like baseball, and I listened to that episode.
Chris Baker is a good man, and has a wealth of knowledge about baseball games. That was a lot of fun. And
that he does,
and it has inspired me to do other similar types of shows for games in the past, games of the past, and I think. Something strikes me. You might actually be somewhat of a aficionado of games of the past. Is that do I have that right? Or
I've been known to play some games from the past.
So we are of course talking about Generation 16, the story, the definitive encyclopedia, video encyclopedia of the Sega Genesis that Mr. Seward puts together painstakingly. He has a Patreon for that as well, which you should go visit. What is that Patreon link?
Patreon.com whatever the slash is you use on the internet. Generation 16 with no hyphen or space or anything.
Good stuff.
Yes. So please give.
Yes. It is time consuming and expensive to put all that stuff together.
Yes.
So the reason that we have Mr. Seward on this week is I'm not sure if it caused much of a ripple. But it was certainly something that caught my eye, and as soon as I read it, I wanted to get Greg on to talk about it. Recently, it was announced that the license for NASCAR racing games has moved from its previous holder, Eutechnix, to a new holder, a new company called DMI. And this company is one of the main players. The president of the company is named Ed Martin. Mm-hmm. And Ed Martin is quite a household name to fans of NASCAR games. And the new company has, there's not a whole lot of information out, but they've said that they are picking up the license, they are running with it. So I immediately said, well, I don't exactly know what that means, but I bet you I know somebody who does, and that is Mr. Seward. So the first question I have for you, Greg, is when you heard this news, what did you think?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic because NASCAR, people who were into NASCAR, we got kind of spoiled under EA there for a while because their Thunder series got really good in the mid-2000s. The U-Technics years have not been kind to the franchise, and I don't know that that's – I don't mean to make that sound like an indictment of U-Technics because I think they actually did a really – they did a decent job getting better through the year, but they just didn't – they didn't deliver. So I've known Ed for a while. Ed actually was working back at Electronic Arts during the NASCAR Thunder series, and I met him back in the early 2000s, and we sort of kept in touch on and off through the years. But I mean, I'm confident because of the fact that he's heading this up, because he knows the sport. He's entrenched in the sport. He's, I believe, in the years that he wasn't doing video games, he was doing licensing or something like that, working directly with NASCAR. So the man knows his stuff.
You know, if you look at the arc of NASCAR video games, there were years where NASCAR video games were very popular, very well received. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have discussed it several times over the years. Some of the best racing games and some NASCAR games were in there. You know, my all-time favorite was Dirt to Daytona. I have never claimed to be a big NASCAR fan, but, you know, a good video game is a good video game. And I think certainly the last few NASCAR games that I've played have been maybe or maybe not technically sound, but certainly very just straightforward. And there wasn't a whole lot going on that if you were not really into NASCAR would grab you. That's my sense. Has that been your sense as well?
Yeah, and the problem was there because, again, going back to – and I'm going to say this. I'm not 100% sure. I'm like frantically trying to look this up as we're talking. But I want to say that Ed was actually involved in Dirt to Daytona as well. If not, he was involved in NASCAR Heat, which was the predecessor.
Yeah, in fact, if you played Dirt to Daytona, some of the splash screens and loading screens were like NASCAR Heat 2. So yeah. Clearly there was a late name change to that.
It was NASCAR Heat. So anyway, getting back to it, yeah, that was kind of the problem that happened with NASCAR, with the games in general, because back in the late 90s, I'm going to go back even further, if you weren't playing on the PC – then the NASCAR games were terrible. The early EA games were just awful. They weren't treated as a sport, which I know that you can debate whether you want to call racing a sport. But either way, like, they didn't really respect the license so much. You would get like a few of the licensed tracks. You would get, you know, a NASCAR race has 43 cars in it, and that's the number. Like, they do their best to make sure they have at least 43 cars in the field. Most of the time they're whittling down the field to 43. But back in the day, like, you got 20 cars and some real drivers and some fake drivers, and they were just terrible games. But as they got through the early 2000s, they started to get really, really good, and they started to add things like the lower series, which I think is now called the Xfinity series, was the Busch series and the Nationwide series. They added the trucks. Dirt to Daytona went even further back than that. Mm-hmm. And so did Thunder with like the Featherlight Modifieds and even Dirt Track, like Street Stock Racing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that was kind of the era where I think what you're talking about was true, where anybody could pick it up and you'd have something to play at least. Like, you'd have something different to try. Like, the cars all handled a little bit differently. You had different tracks. It was great. But speaking as a diehard NASCAR fan, those were actually sort of the salad days for us as well, because there was this very stringent sort of respect for the license. It wasn't like super authentic because they were console games, but you know, they respected the NASCAR fan, and they gave them, you know, what was as close to an authentic experience as possible. And when U-Technics took over, they had a lot of growing pains, and they had, you know, their freshman effort wasn't good. And it wasn't only because the driving itself wasn't great, but it was almost like a lack of knowledge of the sport, just basic rules and the way things should happen, like when yellow flags would come out, or stupid nitpicky things like the pit boxes being on the wrong side of pit road on certain tracks because they had to save memory and that sort of thing. Like, just a lot of really nitpicky stuff that honestly, someone who was only a casual fan probably wouldn't even have picked out, but the hardcore fan wasn't being serviced at all. It was just all you were doing was seeing all these things that you wished weren't like that. So
describe Ed Martin, because I really don't know anything about him, but in reading about this and seeing some of the comments, clearly Ed Martin is somebody, and you already alluded to it, someone you have faith in to reestablish a NASCAR video game. What has he brought to the table, and why are you – you know, what about Ed Martin makes you excited that he is now back at the helm? And granted, we're talking about a game that won't show up until at least sometime in 2016, and maybe even longer. So this is not a short-term thing. But what does he specifically bring to the table? Do you think that's gonna have you keeping your eye out for when, you know, his first next NASCAR game does hit the streets?
Right, and it should be noted that he actually was working with U-Technics before this. I don't think he was there for the first year, but he was there for the subsequent years. But the thing with, and this is based on, you know, not having worked directly with him or anything like that, but my understanding of him and from speaking to him years ago is, again, he understands the sport and he understands sort of the ins and outs of the sport. And something that the DMI page mentioned when the announcement happened is something along the lines of there. I'm reading the line here. To give you some context, a contemporary NASCAR video game has over 1,000 licensed and approved properties in it.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of stakeholders and people to get organized. My understanding is that is one of the things he's good at, which is great because, again, speaking as a hardcore fan, and this was something...
Authenticity, right?
Exactly. And this is something that was happening in the U-Technics games. And again, it might have been a money thing. You get a bunch of drivers that they're fictional drivers, fictional cars. And that's not what you want to see. You know, like if I buy an F1 game, I want to see every F1 team. I want to see the proper liveries. I want to see the proper names. If I buy an NBA game, I want NBA teams. I want NBA players. It's the exact same thing. So I think that's one of the main things he brings to a situation like this. And again, just from hanging out with him again years ago, he's a fan. He's a big fan of this sport and he knows it inside out. So I would hope that he would, again, bring that authenticity.
So let's talk a little bit. You know, one of the things that I'm just really always fascinated by is how games and the industry is constantly evolving week to week, month to month. You know, sports video games are right there. I mean, you saw the introduction of a game like the Golf Club last year, which is basically a video game as a service. You know, of course, you've still got your traditional, you know, major league games, and they're huge. You know, you look at a game like NBA 2K, which has like 6 or 7 major modes with where you could just sink hundreds of hours into easily and never see the same thing twice. You know, you have all of these big time games, and even like, again, you look at an NBA where you've got a career mode with a story around it, and you've got a GM mode where you can do all sorts of stuff. How will NASCAR be able to compete not just with the sports games of today, but also, you know, when compared to the Gran Turismos and the Forzas? From the outside looking in, if it's just NASCAR, it's automatically, dramatically shrinking almost what it can do, because Forza has supercars and stock cars and everything in between, and you know, Gran Turismo and Forza can really go in 20 different directions, whereas NASCAR, it is NASCAR. So how do you think that the NASCAR franchise can sort of emerge with a differentiator, you know, in the current or what will be the current climate, you know, next year and the next couple of years?
Well, that's a good question because, I mean, on the surface, it can't. You know, you've got NASCAR being included in some of these other, especially the Gran Turismo series now. I mean, the only thing I can say is, again, if you're looking for a NASCAR experience, you're not going to get it in those games. Those games play great, and I think that they modeled those cars really well, and they handle mostly the way they should, although the pack racing in the super speedways in Gran Turismo 5, at least, was not good. But if you want, you know, for me personally, what I'm looking for is the entire roster of tracks and a season mode, which you're not going to get in those games. That's not what those games do. And how that they've dealt with it in the past, and the F1 games from Codemasters have done this as well, Actually, heck, F1 Games have done this since like Monaco GP back on the Genesis, is career modes where you actually work your way up. Because it's true in both series, but in NASCAR and in F1, you know, you have your top teams. In NASCAR, you've got Hendrick and you've got Joe Gibbs Racing and you've got right now Tony Stewart, Stewart Haas Racing, are kind of like the pinnacle of the sport. Those are the cars that, you know, you want to get into if you're going to be a champion. I mean, Hendricks had six championships in the last 8 years or something like that, and Roush has had one, and Joe Gibbs Racing has had a couple, and Stuart Haas has had two in the last 3 or 4 years. So that's where you want to be. So the whole idea is you play your own avatar, and you start in a lower team, and you work your way through multiple seasons and work your way up to better cars. That's something I think that they can bring to the table again to differentiate themselves, and that's something that the Thunder series from EA was doing. And then they expanded it even further again by adding those lower tiers, which I thought was a great addition. And then also going back to something like Dirt to Daytona, one of the things I really loved about that series that I would love to see make a resurgence is actually running your own team and actually balancing which races you were going to take on just for the prize money and things like that. You know, like your schedule, you're in the top leagues, but then there's like a dirt track race on a weekend that there's no other race scheduled. Well, I'm going to go there and I'm going to make a little bit extra money. I'm going to get a sponsor for that. And that's the type of thing that they can differentiate. It's really the management and the career progression, as opposed to here's a series of three races, one on a NASCAR track and two on tracks that those cars have never been on. Go out and win gold. That's Gran Turismo. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just a different experience within the same game, but it's not giving you the authentic experience that the actual sport does.
Does some sort of a cinematic storyline involving relationships with other drivers or family members or some sort of drama, does that interest you? Could something like that inject itself positively
Absolutely.
Into a game like this? Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, people always make the jokes about the rednecks with NASCAR just wanting to see the next crash. I don't believe that's totally true. That is true of some fans. But I mean, one of the wonderful things about NASCAR, when you watch it, if you're invested in it, is the personality of the drivers. You know, certain drivers drive different ways. You've got guys like Ryan Newman who are very sort of all business and they're hard to pass and they're fast, but they're, you know, they're not doing anything too erratic usually. And then you've got extremely talented guys like Kyle Busch, who's pretty erratic, but, you know, he's always right on the edge of control in his car, but he's the fastest guy on the track on a good day. So, and going back again to the Thunder series, they actually did do something like this where they had a rival system in the game for a couple of years where if you were related, because there are some drivers out there that have brothers and fathers and sons, and also if you were on the same team, those drivers would help you while you're on the track. Like instead of trying to pass you, they might get in behind you to try to draft instead. And then other drivers you could build alliances with, or you could, you know, if you end up wrecking them, then they would hate you and they would actually go out of their way to make life difficult for you. The problem with that setup was that the AI wasn't good enough for it to be too effective. When there was a driver who was trying to make your life hard, making your life hard was unrealistically swerving across the track and wrecking you anytime you came near him. It didn't really lend itself to a good right. experience.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you know, you could rewrite something like that and you could make it happen. And it's absolutely a major part of the sport. You know, there are guys out there that don't like each other. They just don't like each other. And it's one of the reasons why I enjoy watching it, because you know when, you know, like Kevin Harvick and Kyle Busch are going to get near each other on the track, there's a 90% chance that something's going to happen. And that's the excitement of it. And that's something that I think a NASCAR game needs to capture. They tried to do it about 9 years ago, and I think they need to revisit it now.
What about historical racers or events? You know, would there ever be a situation where you could see somehow working in, you know, the King, Richard Petty, or Cale Yarborough, you know, reaching back into the very rich history of NASCAR as a sport? Could something like that also be part and parcel of some aspect of the game? And would that be welcomed by people like you, big NASCAR fans?
I would absolutely love something like that. Codemasters actually went after something like that a couple of years ago in their F1 games. And it was kind of cool, although, you know, there weren't enough cars and there weren't enough tracks to make it really, really effective. But yeah, I think that that's something that fans would really go crazy for. I mean, there's, you know, this series has been around for 65 years now or something like that. And there's some huge names. You could tie it in with, they have a Hall of Fame now that they induct 5 new people. I think it's 5 every year. And yeah, I mean, you've got all these great old cars and old liveries that you could bring back and put, even if you're just putting them on new tracks, that would be something spectacular to see. I would love to see them try something like that.
So, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, the juxtaposition of a game like the Golf Club versus something like NBA 2K. Now, I think there's, you know, it's an interesting thing. For example, you look at golf, right? Golf, yes, it does have a season every year. You know, it starts at a certain point and ends at a certain point in the calendar year. But a golf season doesn't have the same sense that a basketball season does or a hockey season does, where there's right. a clear beginning and then there's a playoff and then there's a champion. Golf kind of feels like it goes on all the time. And I know racing starts early, and the NASCAR season starts, I believe, in February with the
22nd.
You know, with not that you're counting, with the Daytona 500, and ends, what, October? When does this
October or November, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So
in Florida again.
It's virtually year-round. And,
yeah.
You know, and it's also kind of strange in that its championship race is at the start of the year as opposed to the end of the year, although it's not really the championship, but it is.
They call it their Super Bowl. Right, it's, exactly. Yeah, it's the most hype for sure.
Yeah. To me, like golf, to me, NASCAR feels like it would be better suited as a not an annual release. It feels to me like, especially now that that's sort of an established pattern with certain kinds of games, that it would be better for everybody if it could be a subscription service or some sort of game as a platform.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, do you feel the same way, or do you anticipate perhaps this being, you know, NASCAR 16, NASCAR 17, NASCAR 18?
No, I absolutely do think that is the way they should go. I have a suspicion that was the way Utechnics wanted to go, but I don't know that. Yeah, because the thing is that the cars don't radically change from year to year. I mean, they'll have big changes. They've done a few in the past few years where they tried to go to a much safer car that it was much safer, but it was really boxy and ugly and had a big wing on the back and nobody really went for it. And now they're into Gen 6. They call it Gen 6, which is what they're sitting at now. And it's created quite a lot of good racing, actually. So, you know, but I mean, that's just a car model change. That's something you could do in a patch easily. New liveries every year, same thing. You patch that easily. And the nice thing about a NASCAR game is you really don't need to show the drivers if you don't want to. So it's not like an NBA game where you would have hundreds of players remodeled because you see them constantly. I mean, you see their bodies constantly and their faces constantly. Mm-hmm. In a racing game, you don't see that. So it would be perfect for some kind of subscription service. And I think that it would help to offset the ridiculous amount of licensing they have to deal with as well.
So assuming the money works, because obviously everybody has to make money on this for it to be successful, sounds like you're on board with that. Would you like, what would you be willing to pay for a NASCAR as a service as opposed to a box copy of NASCAR 16? Like what sort of dollars would you be? This is a no brainer. I'd have to think about it, but I could be talking into it, man. Versus not going to happen.
That's a good question. I don't even know. Probably $10 to $15 a month would be my high end.
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
You know, if you're subscribed to a year, that's, you know, $120 to almost $200.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. But see, you know what it all comes down to is this, because I look at a service like iRacing.
Which I know you love.
Which I do love. And I don't remember what the price of that per month is, but it's not much less than that. If it's even, it might even be more.
Are you currently subscribed to that?
I am not right now. No, because my computer just was not capable of running it. And honestly, I just haven't had the time to play it. The thing is to make that – see, I guess I should qualify that. To make it worth that price would be have to be something that I would play all the time. So it would need to be more than that single-player mode. And that was one of the big, big, big problems with the U-Technics games is they had online racing. It was terrible. Their net code was absolutely atrocious. It was so hard to get a race to actually run. But the thing is that if you could get that sort of thing working, then it would be worthwhile. But I'd say, yeah, probably I would go as high as $10 a month. So I would if it was a good game. That's the big thing, though, is that there's going to be a ton of growing pains, no matter who it is. And I'm not 100% convinced that DMI is not going to be taking code from U-Technics on this. There's some mention of that in the announcement. And again, I know that Ed was working with them. So I don't know if this is sort of a continuation because U-Technics is dropping this in favor of their big game is Auto Club Revolution, which is their, I think it's an always online game as well. So it might be a situation where they don't want to pay for the license anymore. They've let it lapse. But we could be getting a next-gen version of what the U-Technics game was. We really don't know yet. And if that was the case, no, I doubt I would even want to pay full price for a box copy at that point.
So how what are some ways that online racing could work? I mean, because for me, one of the challenges of NASCAR online is that you got to get everybody together at the same time. And we know for many people, yourself and myself included, having a particular set time to do something with a video game is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that they could introduce a competition, because you know NASCAR races, by the way, are not generally speaking short, right?
But you can make them short.
Yeah, you can, I guess. I don't know. One of the challenges to me would be if you're subscribing to a game as a service, would be able to get some, maybe not all, but at least some of the racing asynchronous to where you could participate in a race with a group of people and not have to have all of those people together at the same time. Is there a way that something like that could work?
I don't see asynchronous racing working. And the reason is this. It basically, NASCAR and stock car racing in general, unlike, say, well, Formula One actually isn't so much like this anymore as well. But the thing is that people make jokes about oval track racing. All you're doing is driving in a circle. That's absolutely true. All you're doing is driving in a circle. And that would be boring and just a waste of time if you were out there by yourself. Excuse me. The thing is that you're out there with 42 other cars. That's what makes it exciting. That's what makes it interesting to watch. That's what makes it interesting to play. Asynchronous play on something like that, I don't see that working outside of doing something like a drive-a-tire system like the Forza games use. But if that's the case, really, you're just playing single-player again. You're playing AI.
Because to me, like, part of the fun of the NASCAR games in the past was the practice laps and then the qualifying and then the race. Mm-hmm. If there was a way that you could, you know, be able to qualify independently but then maybe just have the race at a certain time. You know, just – again, I'm thinking out loud here because there's got to be – to me, for the next NASCAR game to be successful, it has to be – there has to be something that makes it more appealing to a wider group of people when it comes to online. Because if it's not – I mean, all we ever hear about online racing are two things. Number one, everybody drives like a maniac and just smashes into each other, and that's not fun. Mm-hmm. Or number two, just the code, the net code is broken and cars wind up driving backwards, you know, and things like that.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, again, just thinking out loud without having a whole lot of good ideas, just I would imagine there have to be some new and interesting ways to get people to be racing online, even if they're not online racing together at the same time.
Yeah, that's quite a conundrum. But I mean, the thing is that, like, you're talking about bad net code. That's not a foregone conclusion. There have been plenty of games in the past that have proven that's not the case. I mean, back in 2003, I was playing in an online league with the Papyrus NASCAR game on PC, and it ran beautifully. It was very, very few issues. So there obviously has to be a way to do it. But that's the thing, which is why I think that talking about it as a service is premature.
Okay.
We're not there yet. And the thing is now it's a new group taking over again. I don't know if they're starting from scratch or not. I kind of hope they are. But what I do think they could easily do is just do yearly updates that weren't full price, you know, and didn't even require you to buy a new disc. Let's do patches every 2 years or something like that, as opposed to a new game every single year. But again, I don't know. I don't really know the financials behind all of that.
Right.
But I would love, I mean, other drivers crashing into you, that's like any other racing game. And the thing is that you've got to find, you've got to do one of two things. You could go the iRacing route, which I don't think a single disciplined racing game can do. Because with iRacing, it's all about your reputation, and your reputation is won or lost based on your ability and how cleanly you drive with other people. If you're constantly running into other people and you're constantly wrecking other people, you're never going to make it out of the bottom tier. So the other drivers will move away from you and they don't have to deal with you anymore. And of course, as you get up to those upper levels, everyone's there because they're good at what they're doing and they're not out there to wreck everyone. The flip side of that is like any other racing game, just you'd have to stay within a group that you like, a group that, you know, I mean, with the Gran Turismo series on Player One Podcast, I've been lucky enough that there were enough people excited about that series that we got a couple of championship online seasons put together, and for the most part, we all race each other really cleanly, give or take a couple people. So, you know, I get on there with randoms, and it would just be a mess, but I get on there with the same people that I raced every week, and it was fantastic. So it would be the same this way as well.
There is nothing like it. I mean, we talk about it all the time. We're in a Madden league, and Madden is fantastic when you're playing with a bunch of your friends.
That's, exactly.
You know, yep, totally agreed.
It's like anything else.
Yep, totally agreed. One of the other interesting things that came out of it was that DMI is also has the rights to all of the mobile games and mobile properties. And I know that you have found some real gems, mobile racing games in the past. Does that interest you? And you know, have you dabbled in any of the properties that they have acquired? And does that also interest you, perhaps moving forward as either a complement to the bigger game, or even just, you know, on its own?
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for Racing Manager. Actually, on your show, I talked about Motorsport Manager last year, which was great. I think it was Utechnics. Anyway, whoever had the previous license, I don't know if they outsourced it or they did it themselves, but they did release a mobile version, which was basically a manager. It wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible. I mean, it could have, you know, given a couple of years to sort of gestate and evolve a little bit. I think it could have been a worthwhile game. So there's definitely room for something like that. I mean, it's not like there's a glut of those sort of games on mobile. So you could easily, and having the NASCAR licenses would make a huge difference. So you could easily do something on a mobile platform as well. But I don't see a good real-time driving game with this license on a mobile platform. Not yet, anyway.
So last question for you, Mr. Greg Seward. When you saw the news and you've been thinking about it, had some time to process it, is this good news for NASCAR fans that, you know, a new company helmed by a veteran in the series now has this license and are moving forward with it? Because it's been a rough patch for NASCAR. Do you feel that this is good news, and are you excited about it?
Absolutely. The Utechnics games, they were, the first year was rough. The second year showed a little bit of promise, and then I'm not sure what happened after that, but it seemed like they sort of settled on just a reskin every year thing. And I want to say that it's because they moved away to their own property. So yeah, I mean, it had stagnated to the point. I didn't play last year's game. There is one coming out this year, but it's again, just a reskin on the 360 and the PS3.
Right.
So I'm just not interested. The game wasn't good enough, to justify buying it every year. And this is coming from somebody who since 2001, had bought it every single year. So I have faith that a company helmed by Ed can do something good with this license. Whether they will or not remains to be seen, but sure. I'll definitely be paying attention.
Fantastic. Well, Greg Seward from the Best Show on the Internet, the Player One podcast, and the man behind the great Generation 16. Thank you, sir, as always, as the official racing correspondent of the Press Row podcast. Your insight is always greatly appreciated. I hope you enjoy the Daytona 500 coming up in not that long of a time. And thanks, as always, for coming on, and we will talk to you again real soon.
Thank you.
All right. One of the coolest things that happens when you have been doing this show for as long as we have now is you get to see various changes. Some of those changes are good. Some of those changes may not be so good. But in the past week or so, one of the coolest little changes that we've seen happen has happened. If you are not familiar with the Out of the Park baseball franchise, shame on you, because it has for years been beloved by many, especially those in the Operation Sports community, as a baseball sim and its various incarnations on PC and Mac and as well as on mobile devices and things like that. But it has always been a non-licensed game and has not really suffered because of it, but certainly, you know, every little bit of authenticity that you can add to a game will increase its appeal. And this is no small bit of authenticity. In fact, it was just recently announced that the Out of the Park baseball franchise has acquired the rights to Major League Baseball. So joining us today is Brad Cook from Out of the Park. Brad, welcome back, first of all, to the Press Row podcast. It's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on again.
And second of all, congratulations. This is something that is a huge deal for you and a huge deal for fans of the franchise. It's something that we have talked about on the show and in Hangouts and in various forms for the last few years, sort of putting it out there, saying, what would it mean? So congratulations on the MLB franchise. What does it really mean, both to you and to the fans of the Out of the Park baseball video game?
Thanks. Yeah, it's really been a long time coming. It's a great thing for us. We're really excited about it. We think it just, like you said, it adds that air of authenticity. It's really nice that people can just launch a new league and boom, they have all those logos there. They don't have to fiddle with anything. We get, you know, some marketing support from MLB on their side, which is nice. And for fans, we hope that it just really, helps the immersion factor. One of the other cool things is, you know, since we have 3D in the game now, we can now have 3D versions of all 30 Major League Baseball stadiums in the game, which are in there now too, which is cool. So, we just hope, you know, it'll help people and it'll help expose us to a whole new, bunch of people who maybe didn't know we existed before and who will check out the game.
So there are two main versions, and correct me if I'm wrong, of Out of the Park. There is the, you know, the PC based game, and there is the mobile game, you know, on tablets and such. So let's talk about the PC game. when will we see the result of this on on the PC, and really, you know, what are some of the things you touched on it a little bit, but you know, when will we see it, and what are some of the things that you'll really notice, that are really different now that you have the rights to the teams and the leagues and the assets and all those different things affiliated with real Major League Baseball?
Yeah, well, both games will ship in March. We don't have a specific shipping date yet, but we expect it, you know, to be close to opening day. You know, in the past, we've been a little bit after opening day, and this time we're hoping to be ahead of the curve there. And as we announced in our newsletter last week, the mobile game is now called MLB Manager. So that's a big change there. And that game will be on Android now as well as iOS. And then another newsletter will be coming out in February that will give details on all the new features in that game. That game will, of course, have all the logos and everything, like the PC game. They'll both be out in March. And as in the past, people who pre-order can get the game 3 days early, as well as get a free Steam game, Steam key. And then we've got through the February 15th, we've got the sweepstakes where we're giving away three $500 MLB.com shop gift certificates, which are good for, you know, jerseys, caps, and all kinds of other stuff.
Nice. So correct me if I'm wrong, but the MLB license applies not only to the teams, you know, as they are structured in 2015, but also historical teams. Is that correct as well?
Yeah. So, you know, we'll be releasing more screenshots soon, but like one of the screenshots I've seen is one from, you know, the Expos. So if you play historically, you'll get those logos from, you know, the old St. Louis Browns or the Expos or the Colt 45s or any of those teams that existed in the past. You'll get those. And you'll also, one thing I didn't actually mention yet is the fact that we also have it also applies to minor league baseball. So all of the minor league baseball teams and leagues all have authentic logos in the game as well. So as you check out your farm system and check out those teams, you'll get all those logos too.
So for people who are not familiar with Out of the Park Baseball, we'll keep it on the PC for now. Like, you know, it's a simulator, right? It's a manager. But what are the different ways that you play the game, and what are just, you know, sort of the different types of things that you get to do over the course of time?
Well, you know, I always like to say it's like, you know, putting yourself in the general manager's office, as well as putting yourself in the shoes of the manager in the dugout during games if you want. But, you know, you can pretty much do everything that the guys who run and women who run major league teams can do. You can trade players, sign free agents. You set your lineups, your pitching rotations. You draft your prospects every June. You oversee your farm system. You know, all your minor league teams are playing games while you're running your major league club. And so you move guys up and down the system, and you can promote them to the big leagues when they're ready and see how they develop. And you can just play on into the future. You can play decades or even a couple centuries into the future and see your team's fortunes rise and fall, and, you know, watch guys retire and get into the Hall of Fame, or maybe see careers tragically cut short, or guys maybe never reach their potential, or maybe they go beyond what you thought they could do. So there's just, I mean, there's so much there. And of course, you can go back to 1871 and play forward through baseball history and recreate all kinds of great past seasons. So yeah, there's a lot there.
And there are certain, like, eras or years that ship with the game, and there are other ones that you can sort of purchase. So how is that structured? You know, if I go and pre-order the game today, which, by the way, I'm going to be doing. this has got me written all over now. You know, but what do I get, like, day one versus what's available for me to potentially dabble and go grab, you know, as, like, historical era stuff or different kinds of things like that?
Well, the PC Mac game comes with all the historical seasons included. You get everything in the game for one price. There's nothing else to add on or purchase later. The mobile game comes with the current season, and then we typically include three historical seasons for free, and then the rest are in-app purchases. And you can also I know last year you could buy all the historical seasons for I believe it was $20 or $25. I'm trying to remember the exact amount, so you could add them all into the game and get all those real players as you play through history. And I expect that to be similar this year. But yeah, on the computer side, one price gets you everything. We always release updates to the game throughout the season. And Marcus is really good about throwing little features in there when we're putting out updates. So there's always little things that get added along the way. But those are all free updates.
What is it about Out of the Park Baseball that strikes such a chord with so many people? Because there are devotees of this franchise that have been for years, and it's not the only game like it on the market, but at least from my perspective, seems to be the most successful. So, what is it about Out of the Park Baseball that has made it so popular with its fans?
Well, I think it's the fact that if this is a game for you, if this is the kind of thing you want to do, there are just so many things you can do with it. I mean, I wrote a post on our blog not too long ago about a Tolkien baseball league. It's actually an online league where someone created teams, and they're all based on the Lord of the Rings universe, Middle Earth, and the player names. He set up the player name file in the game so that it pulls in Elvish and Dwarvish names and all kinds of stuff. So, you can do all kinds of things with the game. You can play it anywhere.